The men's encampment is for the men, and we urge you to be there. I think one of the best blessings of the encampments is not what the men are told, but what the men contribute themselves. Now, this has been true the four or so that I've been a part of here. I think that what you contribute is by far the greatest part of the encampment. So let me urge you to be there, as Dr. Pryor has. Here's your opportunity to help make this congregation what you think God expects it to be. Now, men, this is a responsibility that you have, and you can't pass it off on somebody else. No one else can attend for you. And if you're available and not out of town or in the bed, you get up off your bench and go out here and sign up for this encampment. We need 150 to 200 men out there this coming Friday night. So here's your opportunity to make this church here what you think God would have it to be. And I hope that you'll be there. And then on Sunday night, or really Monday beginning, Landon Saunders will be here for a student retreat. Monday and Tuesday night, and perhaps Wednesday. I'm not exactly sure the length of it. But Landon will be here at the Wildwood Retreat Center also, and he'll be speaking out of the book of 1 John. And I've had the privilege of listening to some of the tape that he made on this subject, and I'll tell you, it's going to be rich. Each evening, you who are resident members of this church are invited to come also. So we want to extend that invitation to you at this time. May I wish each one of you a very happy and prosperous new year as we begin this year together. I want to talk to you this morning on endings. You may think it strange that at the beginning of a new year that we should talk on endings. But I think if you'll reflect just a moment, you'll realize that it's not poor beginnings that mar our years, it's poor endings. Having too much year left over after we've quit trying. That's what really catches us. One of the most telling tests of all tests is not talent or good beginnings. It's endurance. And the tortoise and the hare are that proverbial illustration of that real solid truth. Endurance is where it's at. Did you ever marvel at the composite wonder of a bird's nest? One of my children some years ago brought me a bird's nest, just wide-eyed with amazement, and said, "How in the world did the bird make that?" And I told him, or told her, the bird just did it piece at a time. One insignificant stick or twig at a time. Just a bit of rubbish here and there, but time after time, just sticking with it. There's a castle in southern Greece that overlooks the little city of Nafplion in southern Greece, down below Corinth. And this Crusader's chapel or castle is in itself a monument to endurance, a monument to steadfastness. From Nafplion up to the top of the castle, there are 1,600 steps alone. And those are just the steps. And the castle winds all the way up to that peak and is itself a monument of endurance, because all of those stones had to be carried up that hill and placed there on that mountain. I don't know how they did it. I don't imagine on earth how they did it, but they did it. And it's been standing there for about 1,000 years as a monument to steadfast endurance. What's the secret to a thesis or to a doctoral dissertation? It's not brilliance. Too many of you have gotten one. It's not brilliance. It's persistence, perseverance. You know that's true. Those of you who've gotten one of them, you've written one of them, I see you smiling. It's exactly a result of persistence, perseverance, not brilliance. And that's true, I think, with just about every phase of education. All of education, for the majority of us, is a result of perseverance, not brilliance. And that's fine. I'm thankful that that's true, because so many of us can obtain perseverance that may never have brilliance. And so education then is open to all of us. The correspondence schools make their money, though, off of those who sign up and pay their fee but never finish. And Dr. Joe Pryor told me that of all the freshmen who enroll, only about 55 to 60% ever graduate. Well, whatever happened to the other people? What's the matter? Well, the matter with them is the matter that afflicts most all of life, and that is that not everybody that begins something finishes it. We find ourselves caught in that rut of not finishing what we began. That's why I think so much is said in the Bible about stick-to-itiveness, perseverance, or steadfastness. And the Bible is filled full with fulfilling your ministry. Cram-packed from Genesis to Revelation, it talks about fulfilling it, finishing it, taking care of it, and completing your course. That's what it's about. And if you fail in your life this year, it'll be because, not because you didn't make a good beginning, because you've already made your resolutions. And your list may be as long or longer than it was last year. But if you fail, it won't be because of a poor beginning. It'll be because of a poor ending. And the Bible tries to ward off and to help us to circumvent that chug hole that seems to throw us all for a loop sometime during the year. The Bible contains admonitions. It contains warnings. And it's summed up very succinctly in one statement made by Ahab, the king of Samaria, to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. Ben-Hadad besieged the city of Jerusalem, or the city of Samaria. And he had his armies out there that looked just like the sands of the sea. And he made unreasonable demands on Ahab and the people of Samaria. They gave in once and let him have his request. And then he sent back and made further demands. And Ahab said, "That's too much. We're not going to do that." And he called the people. They said, "That's too much." They sent a message to him and said, "We're not going to do it." Ben-Hadad said, "May the gods do so to me and more so if there's enough dust in Samaria for handfuls of those people that follow me." In other words, he's saying there's more of us here than there is dust in this place. And Ahab sent back this message to Ben-Hadad: "Let not him boast who puts on his armor, but him that takes it off." Now, do you understand what? Did you get the message? Let not him boast who puts on his armor, but him that takes it off. In other words, big mouth, just wait and see how the battle comes out. Putting it on is not the answer. The one that's left to take it off is the victor. Now, Jesus, in his teaching, shows us how absolutely essential this very thing of steadfastness and perseverance really is. Jesus put it in the term of putting your hand to a plow. And he said, "Whoever puts his hand to the plow and looks back is not fit for the kingdom of heaven." In other words, the man that begins to do the job and then somewhere along the line looks back and forgets the task that's ahead of him and becomes discouraged or becomes enamored by something else, he's not fit for the kingdom of God. That's why the Hebrew writer said in chapter 3, "Take care, brethren, lest there be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God. For we become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence, firm to the end." And then in that, about the 12th or 13th verse, he said, "So let's encourage each other every day, as long as it is called today, lest any of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin." But he said, you've got to hold on to the end. That's why in chapter 10, the Hebrew writer says, you have need of perseverance. so that you may do the will of God and receive what's promised. Now, these are all admonitions and encouragements and warnings about the prevalency of failing to complete your course. And we also have examples throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, of people who did finish and people who didn't finish. Good examples and bad examples. The five wise and five foolish virgins, I guess, is the example that contains both bad and good examples. The five wise virgins did provide that which was necessary to see them through the end of their job. The five foolish virgins didn't. They did not have what it took to finish the task. Jesus called them foolish. And then there's that man that Jesus said was the object of scorn. He was the object of mockery. In Luke, the 14th chapter, Jesus tells the story about a man that tried to build a tower. And he said, "What man of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? Else, after having laid the foundation, he's not able to finish it. Everyone seeing it mocks him and says, 'This man began to build but wasn't able to finish.'" And Jesus just simply puts it in everyday context. I've done that. I've seen houses that only had the walls up and the walls were overgrown with moss and with grass and all because the man that started to build it just couldn't finish it. Jesus also put it in another parable, in the parable of the soils, when he told how that there were kinds of soil that received the word. He said one of the kinds of soil was the kind that was shallow. It was on a rock. The rock was underneath it, and it would get all the warmth and retain it, and as a result, it would spring up real quickly. But he said in times of temptation, it would fall away. It wouldn't complete. It would bring forth no fruit. But then Luke says, in Luke, the 8th chapter, that the good soil, that is those people who receive the word in a good and honest heart. And Luke says those who hold it fast in a good and honest heart. I didn't see that until this morning. I was concentrating on the last part of that verse that says, and with patience bring forth fruit. Now, Matthew doesn't mention that in Matthew 13. Matthew just says that they bring forth fruit. Luke says they bring forth fruit with patience. Patience, steadfast, stick-to-itiveness. And Luke has that in mind, and he also elaborates on it just above it when he says that these people hold that word fast, hold it steadfast, hold it secure in a good and honest heart. The book of 2 Timothy, chapter 4, is a book of finishings. Isn't this the last chapter that the Apostle Paul wrote, 2 Timothy, chapter 4? There's no other book that he wrote after that. There he talks about the end of his life. He says, "I'm already at the point of being offered. I'm ready. The time of my departure has come." And it's natural then that the last chapter that he would write would be written along the idea of finishings. And consequently, after he says that, he says, "I have kept the faith. I've fought a good fight. I've finished the course." Listen to these words of finality. "I've kept. I have finished. I have fought." And he says, "This is something that I've done." He doesn't brag about it, but he does say that "I have completed what I started." But he mentions in that chapter a man that didn't. The man's name was Demas. Demas got sidetracked. And so we find all the way through the New Testament, all the way through the Bible, we find this task of finishing what you began important. Jesus, our perfect example, when he had despised the shame, endured the cross. In the midst of that ordeal, he hung there on the cross and cried out, no doubt in elation, "It's finished. It's finished." And I thank God that he gave us that example. Have you ever, in your lifetime, approached any major part of your life, begun it, and then some years later completed it to the point that you could say, "Phew, it's finished"? Man, those are some of the most potent words in all writing. It's finished. But I guarantee you one thing: patience or steadfastness or perseverance or stick-to-itiveness is something that you learn. How many of you can remember doing something like that? I can. I was always a good beginner. Man, I was a good beginner. 100-yard dash, man, at the very best, though. And if you really boil it right down, I was a good 40-yard man. Because after burning off the blocks, I'd be ahead of everybody at the 40-yard mark. But then I'd begin to falter. And they'd overtake me and they'd pass and I'd lose the race. I was about like the rabbit instead of the tortoise. But I finally learned, sometime about 35 or 32 or 3, I finally accomplished something that I saw was a sign of my maturing. And I ain't there yet, but I found out, by the way, that stick-to-itiveness is something you learn. I found out that after working a 12-year stint of work in the Scriptures, I realized, by the way, I was about to finish that thing. And I did finish it, and it was a turning point in my life of maturity. I began finally to see I can finish something. I can complete something. And we all need to learn that lesson. And I thank God, and I look back on it with thanksgiving, that I finally learned to finish something that I had begun. How do you go about it, though? There are certain attitudes that are important if you're going to learn how to finish your course. And stop just running from one thing, you know, dabbling with that, and then running over here and dabbling with that, and then running over here and dabbling with that. Much of our lives, until you mature, much of it is spent in that kind of fragmented, unconcentrated messing around. Here a bit, there a bit, jack of all trades, master of none, and we finally find ourselves fritting away our lives on trivia, never majoring in anything, minoring in all things, starting much and finishing nothing. And if that describes you, then may I just suggest you're probably on your way to disaster. You're not going to make anything that will be permanent mark in history. You're going to be just simply forgotten. And I don't know that you'll make it as a Christian unless you learn this very great talent that's available to all of us and just simply stick-to-itiveness. Stay in there with it. Finish what you began. Two or three things are essential, and I want to mention them to you this morning. One is, you've got to have the right attitude about yourself. In order for you to finish your task, you're going to have the right attitude about yourself. One of the wrong attitudes about yourself is this: that's just the way I am. The person who approaches life with the philosophy, well, that's just the way I am, really resigns himself to his own imperfections. He's content to stay in the rut of status quo. We don't have that right. God is the only I am being. He is the only one that has the right to stay as he is. All of us are destined to become. All of us are destined to become. And let me tell you something. If you think that you can stay as you are, you're wrong. You're not going to stay as you are. You're going to get worse. Or else you're going to get better. Because nobody stays where he is. You're going to be different tomorrow than you were today. Oh, you may be in the same rut, but you're going to be deeper in that rut than you were the day before. You never stay the same. God is the only I am being. You were designed or destined because of sin. You and I were destined to become. This is what John meant when he said in John 1:12 that to all that believe on Jesus, that he gave them the power to become sons of God. And in the 2 Corinthians letter chapter 3 in verse 18, Paul makes the statement that we all with unveiled face beholding the glory of the Lord are being changed into his very likeness from one degree of glory to another. On the other hand, evil men are being deceived and are deceiving, and they wax worse and worse. Now, you're in one of those camps. You're in one of those two camps, and so am I. You're either being transformed from one degree of glory into another, into the likeness of Jesus, or you're waxing worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. But there isn't any middle ground. You're in one or the other. So, that's just the way I am. Won't cut it. I don't intend to be the way I am today, next year. I don't intend to be the kind of husband that I am today, 12 months from now. I'm not satisfied with that. I don't intend to be the same preacher that I am today, 12 months from now. I'm not satisfied with that. I want to be more, and we dare not settle for less. But a second bad attitude about yourself is that I've already arrived. If saying, this is just the way I am, causes us to resign ourselves to our imperfection, saying that I've already arrived causes us to be blind to our imperfections. You know, well, I've already arrived, I'm already there. And let me tell you something. If you think that you've already arrived, you have. You really have, exactly. Because with that attitude, you're not going to get any further. You're not going to go anymore. If you've come to the point that you feel like that you've arrived, that's exactly where you're going to stay. You won't progress any further. We mustn't think either individually or collectively that we have such a handle on the message or the method that we cannot get any deeper insight into the meaning or the application of it. This is dangerous for a congregation. It's dangerous for an individual. Any individual Christian who thinks that he's arrived to the point, you know, that he thinks he can know, that he can't learn anything else, and that he has all the truth, and that he has the perfect concept of the truth and the perfect application of the truth, that person is in a dangerous position. Congregations can get in the same predicament. Well, this is the way we've always done it. As though to say this is the way it ought to be done, and we're satisfied with what we have, we've already arrived, let us alone. But that's the state of perennial death. It's not the state of life. Life changes, life goes on, and you need not think that you've arrived unless you intend to just stay like you are. But that is it's deceptive. The hardness and the deceitfulness of sin will cause you to think that you can stay like you are, but you can't. Rather, we ought to be like Paul. Paul says, I'm not yet there. He said, I haven't arrived. He said, I'm not yet made perfect. But I press on, forgetting those things that are behind, straining toward that which is ahead. I press on toward the goal of the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. That's what we need to be saying. Someone gave me a plaque 2 or 3 years ago, and I think there was method in the student's madness. This plaque is in there on my desk. It's about so big, and it says simply, be patient with me. God isn't finished with me yet. And I think that this person had seen my imperfections and just wanted to help me understand that I wasn't there yet and that people need to be patient with me. And you do. You're going to have to be patient with me this year. I'm not there yet. I'll have to be patient with you. You're not there yet either. You'll have to be patient with our elders. They're not there yet. But our attitude toward ourselves is so vitally important. Is yours a good attitude? Are you willing to stay like you are? Do you think you've arrived? Are you willing to just say, well, that's just the way I am? Well, don't do that. But a second thing is your attitude toward other people. There are three negatives I'd like to mention here that are essential if you're going to make a success of your life. Number one is, don't let your faith rest in other people. Don't let your faith rest in other people. If you do, you know what's going to happen? When those people stumble and fall, then your faith will fall with them. You're going to be very disillusioned, and you may become so discouraged that you actually quit. The Apostle Paul, in this same chapter, fourth chapter of 2 Timothy, he mentions the fact that at his first defense, nobody took his part. They all forsook me, he said, but the Lord stood by me. And he gave me the strength, he says, to proclaim the word fully so that all the Gentiles might hear. Thus I was rescued out of the mouth of the lion. He says, and he'll rescue me from every evil and will save me for his heavenly kingdom. Paul didn't have his faith in people. Had he would have been discouraged and quit long ago. He set his eye on the Lord. And that's what the Hebrew writer says we ought to do. Look to Jesus. Run this race and look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. He's the only one that is meriting, or he's the only one that merits your gaze, your steady concentration. Look to Jesus Christ. Don't look at me. Don't look at these folks. You look to the Lord. But a second thing that about your attitude toward other people, not only don't let your faith rest in them, but don't let your battle depend upon others' battles. Don't let your fighting depend upon their fighting. That would mean young people, and especially as a youth, as a young person, so many times we let our fight depend upon somebody else's fight. And that means simply that we do right as long as we're around somebody else that's doing right. But if we're around folks that are doing wrong, we do wrong. But that's, man, you won't do anything but tread water that way, and you'll be sinking all the time. Don't let your fight depend upon somebody else's fight. Be like Joshua. Joshua said, choose today whom you're going to serve, whether the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, or the gods of your fathers that were beyond the river. But he said, as far as me and my house are concerned, we're going to serve the Lord. Now that just simply meant, I don't care what you do, I'm going to serve God. You can serve whoever you please. Serve whatever God you choose. But I've already made up my mind, I'm going to serve the Lord. And then the third false attitude toward other people is, don't judge other people or let them judge you. Don't measure yourself by other folks. So many times when we do this, we get discouraged. We measure ourselves with somebody else that's doing better and we're discouraged. Or we turn around and measure ourselves by somebody who's less than we think we are, and we become encouraged. Paul said, as long as you measure yourselves by yourselves and judge yourselves with yourselves, he said, you're always going to be without understanding. 2 Corinthians, the ninth chapter. Would you believe the 10th chapter? So don't judge yourselves by other people, nor judge other people by yourself. Paul says we'll all have to stand before God. We'll all have to receive the things that we've done in our body. But then finally, after the proper attitude toward yourself, not thinking that you've arrived, and not being content to just be like you are, and then the proper attitude toward other people, don't let your faith rest in people, and don't let your fight depend upon their fighting, and don't judge them by you nor you by them, then finally this, you're going to have the right attitude toward obstacles, toward hardships and trials. If you make it through this year, and if this year represents your life, if this is a small portion of your life as a whole, and after all, that's what life is, it's just one year at a time, and really it's just one day at a time. But let's blow it up to one year at a time, and let's look at this coming year that we're in as a portion of the whole. If you're going to make it successfully, you're going to have the right attitude toward trials and tribulations. If you're always going around saying, well, the reason why I'm not what I ought to be is because I'm in the wrong place. As long as we go around thinking that it's circumstances and locations that keep us from doing what we ought to do, you're not going to make it. I know. I spent many years thinking, well, the reason really I ought to be over there. And I'd be happy if I could just be over yonder. My wife had about 15 years of that rubbish, and she said to me one day, why don't you try to learn to just be happy where you are? I thought, that does make sense, doesn't it? Because I was always saying, oh, you know, it's over there. But I went over there and it wasn't there. Not really, but I was always pretty well happy wherever I was, but I always was looking somewhere else. And you frit away your life like that. How many of you have spent time thinking, you know, if I could just be over yonder, I'd be all right. If I were just married, I'd be all right. Or if I just had children, or if I just had my children raised. Or if I could just be in that job, or if I could just be in that state. If I just had another wife, if I just had another husband, if I just had something. Always looking to circumstances and locations as being the cause of our failure. That's not the cause of your failure. You're the cause of your failure. Because once you get from here to there, you know who you take with you? You take old John with you. There he is, same old person. And I've seen people sit in boat docks. I've seen people sit in airline terminals. And they have that far-off glint in their eye. They're looking for it somewhere else. It's not there. You're going to have to learn the real meaning of adversity and trials and tribulations. Rather, you're going to have to see that trials refine your faith just like fire refines gold, Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1. What are all these trials for? They're to refine your faith if you've got any faith. What are all the tribulations and the pressures? What's it all for? Well, if you've got faith, God is using these things to rub you and polish you to a luster. And as certain as you run from all the abrasions and run from all the tests and run from all the trials, you're running from the very thing that God has designed as an instrument to polish you up and make you what you ought to be. And so many times we just run from one adversity into another, you know, and then run from that one and run from that one. And you know who the worst of all of these are? Preachers. Preachers are the worst lot in the world of running from one congregation to another. Why? Well, you've got problems there. You sure did. You were there. If you were preaching there, you know. That's why they had some of the problems. You'll have to learn the purpose of adversity. That's why Paul says we rejoice in our struggles, or we rejoice in our afflictions. We rejoice in our trials or our temptations. James says the same thing, because that's the purpose of these. They're to make you what you ought to be. Paul told the people in Acts the 14th chapter, one of the churches there, he said, it's through many struggles or tribulations we enter the kingdom of God. So in order to be the person that you ought to be, you're going to have the right attitude toward yourself, the right attitude toward other people, the right attitude toward adversity. In order to make one tablespoon of honey, it requires a bee 4,200 trips to the source of the nectar. Can you imagine that? One tablespoon. 4,200 trips. Now, brethren, that's stick-to-itiveness. That's real patience. Now, listen to me. If a dumb bee, and if you'll allow me to call him dumb, if an inhuman, subhuman order of the universe, if a dumb bee is willing to make 4,200 trips to make a teaspoon or a tablespoonful of honey, surely, as a son of God, you and I can stick with it long enough to become what God wants us to be. You can do what Paul said, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. He has something good ahead for us. So this year, I would begin it by urging you to be steadfast. It's a sign of your maturity. And until you reach that point where you're willing to not only begin, but to finish what you began, we're not really showing much sign of maturity. May God bless you. I look forward to being with you this year. Let's look forward to being with each other. And let's do what the Hebrew writer says, exhorting each other, encouraging each other, every day as long as it's called today, lest any of us be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Let's encourage each other as we sing, as we stand, and if you have need to come forward and make some request, or if you'd like to become a child of God today and you're aware of what the faith is and what your requirement is for you to do in order to become a Christian, whatever may be your need, would you come while we stand and sing?